This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Yes, it is. It's Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education. Wednesday classes in session. Johnny Lupinacci, how you doing, my buddy?
I'm doing well, Tim. Doing well. Lots of great conversations going on. Excited for today. Classes in session for sure. You know, maybe a little bit of de-schooling or unschooling here, but great guests today, and I'm excited to pick up where we left off in that conversation, Tim, with, you know, naming the moment, paying attention to the things happening all around us, and figuring out how we, you know, unify and build solidarity around this moment, because boy, democracy is in some trouble. And you know what that means? It means we get together and we fight the good fight. So we got a great guest today, Tim. Let's jump into it.
Yeah, let's jump in. He is the he's a distinguished professor of education, lifelong activist, author of groundbreaking works like Teaching Toward Freedom and To Teach: The Journey of a Teacher. His ideas have challenged conventional wisdom and inspired generations of educators to think critically, act boldly, and never settle for the status quo. Buckle up, listeners. Welcome to Busted Pencils. Bill Ayers. Bill, what's happening, our friend?
It's great to see you again. Been a long time.
It's been a while. We said it's, you know, I think the last time was right before COVID. We were at our mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Kevin Kumashiro's conference in Hawaii. So it is great to have you back. Bill, jumping right into it, though, we had Kevin on, in fact, a couple weeks ago, helping us name this moment. Very particular, just in case anybody needs a reminder, this moment is President-elect Trump. In fact, you know, too, if you have your own ideas about how to name this moment, we'd love to hear from you. 608-557-8577. That's the Busted Pencils mailbag, 608-557-8577. But yeah, our guest, Bill Ayers. Bill, the moment here, President-elect Trump is now almost, you know, we're like in that realm of 30-some days before he is officially going to be President Trump. Us in public education and advocates, what are we supposed to do, Bill?
Well, what are we supposed to do? There's so much to do. The one thing we're not supposed to do is surrender, back up, or sit down and be quiet. One of the things that all the noise, all the chaos, all the excitement, all the appointments, all the gasping and clutching of pearls does is confuse us. And it's all part of a strategy. So I think we have to remind ourselves that the fight continues, that it's not a completely new day. And if I'm naming the political moment, I name it a moment of contradiction. That is, in many ways, it feels, and this is what you're alluding to, it feels like the worst of times. What could be worse? You know, an avowed fascist in the White House, white supremacists on the rise and feeling overconfident, way too happy, racialized, militarized police forces continuing their violence unchecked, women's bodily integrity under sustained attack, a genocidal war in Gaza, fully funded and supported by U.S. taxpayers, and so on. So it feels like the worst of times. But on another level, and another way of looking at it, these times are not the worst of times. We have incredible resistance to the war, for example, in Gaza, to war in general. We have the Black Lives Matter movement. We have the greatest outpouring against racial violence in history in 2002. We have women refusing to return to the Middle Ages or a medieval definition of their rights. And I think all of these things make me think that we have a lot of possibilities, a lot of things we can do and we must do. And so while it seems like sometimes the worst of times, other times it feels like pretty good times. So I think Charles Dickens would understand our predicament perfectly. It's the winter of despair and the summer of hope. And I think that we have to see it that way, because one thing that is, as I said in the beginning, is not an alternative is to sit down, shut up, and kind of lick our wounds and deal with our grief individually. We can't do that. So what should we do? We should study more. We should get into groups. We should organize study groups and action groups. We should think hard about more vulnerable people than ourselves and what we intend to do in support, what we intend to do in solidarity if people are moved on in a massive way. I think these are the things we need to do, we must do, and we can do.
Johnny Lupinacci, jump in there.
Well, so much Bill offers right there, and I'm still, you know, writing it down, and I'm inspired by that statement, the winter of despair and the summer of hope, you know, reminding us too that we are having this conversation amidst the largest social uprising of all of our lifetimes, and we've been around for a minute here. We've seen some social uprising. So understanding the energy and the support coming from primarily also youths and activists around this country and around the world, you know, to be better citizens, to be better stewards of the planet, and that in mass, we care deeply about social justice and environmental sustainability. So I love that statement. I'm going to say it again. It's, you know, naming this moment as a moment of contradiction. Bill Ayers with us today saying it's the winter of despair and the summer of hope. You know, and so, Bill, can you expand on that a little bit for our listeners? Because I'm inspired.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that you know, I'm often accused of being an optimist, which is an unfair criticism. I am not an optimist. My mother was an optimist. Karl Marx was an optimist. I actually don't know what's coming. And because I don't know, I choose a politics of hope. I've been accused of being a romantic, an idealist, and a utopian. And I remember a dinner we had couple of decades ago with the great Uruguayan revolutionary Eduardo Galeano. And we were talking about people calling us romantics and idealists and utopians. And he made the funniest statement. He said, you know, it's true. Somebody said to me, what good is utopia? And yes, I walk two steps towards utopia. Utopia walks two steps away. I take 10 steps toward utopia. Utopia takes 10 steps away. So what good is utopia? And his answer, it's good for walking. And that's very important to me, is that I am a hopeful person precisely because the day before Rosa Parks sat in on that bus, no commentator or talking head thought that the modern civil rights movement was right around the corner. The day after, everybody said it was inevitable. So I choose to say, because I don't know, I'm willing to try to mobilize, organize, agitate, and move in the direction of my dreams because there's no other place to go. I refuse to cave in despair or weakness to a rising fascist reality. There's one other thing I would say, Johnny, and that is that it should, if you're completely surprised by the Trump election or completely surprised by Trump won, then you don't know what country we live in. Because this is a country that is deeply, deeply inflected with genocide, with white supremacy. In fact, I just wrote this book called When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer. Mm-hmm. And one of the people keep asking me to define freedom, and I don't want to define it because I think it's a layered, complex, dynamic term that gets defined in action. But I will say this, that freedom for the conqueror is always murder and mayhem for the conquered. And that's the fundamental American contradiction. On the one hand, we aspire to freedom. On the other hand, freedom for the colonists was also the freedom to own human beings, the freedom to support the Atlantic slave trade, the freedom to expand westward and destroy entire peoples. So that's the freedom we do not want to embrace. We want to come to a different understanding. And within that American contradiction, we want to see freedom as an aspiration for all human beings to a more just, a more joyful, a more peaceful, and a more balanced world. That's what I'm working for.
Thank you, Bill Ayers, man. We love having you on Busted Pencils. The idea truly naming this a moment of contradiction, but the politics of hope. You made me think, Bill, and it just you kind of put my little geek hat on here. Boy, this sounds to me like you call it utopia, but I'm a Star Trek guy. I'm a Trekkie, and I think of Gene Roddenberry and kind of that vision there, and it sounds similar in that, you know, that our vision shifts away from acquisition and conquer to the lifting of all life, truly creation. And so here we are in this moment. And I think about this too, and it always puzzles me, the attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trying to help people understand, it's like, what is it about? Is it the diversity? Is it the equity? Because maybe we start with inclusion. What is it about being included that makes you fearful? Because to me, inclusion is hopeful. This idea, is it partially, potentially, when I say the left, progressive, whatever you want to define, our vision of inclusion, we haven't been very good of helping people understand that it is an invitation to everybody, and that our definition of inclusion, some people are feeling exclusionary in that sense. I'm just wondering if part of our problem is that we're not great at communicating what we mean by inclusion, diversity, and equity.
Well, I appreciate your pointing to the fact that maybe it's our fault or the fault of those who support that kind of effort, because I think we have to be more self-critical. It's easy to be critical of the, you know, right-wing Republican caucus, the Freedom Caucus in the Congress. Much harder to be self-aware and critical of your own shortcomings. So I appreciate that. I think we have to be clear that when we don't win certain arguments, shame on us. We should go back to the drawing boards and get smarter and get sharper and mobilize more people. I think that on the, you know, this, people find this ridiculous, but to me, on the 15 most important issues, to me, I'm in the majority in this country. I'm not some marginal minority that has to kind of, you know, hide my head or get into my bunker or feel defensive. The problem is we're not always good at communicating. We're not always good at arguing. However, having said that, I think DEI suffers from a couple of problems. One is that when it becomes institutionalized as DEI, that is, when it gets reduced from diversity, equity, inclusion to a slogan, DEI, and it gets endorsed by the National Football League, and everyone has a DEI officer, I become suspicious because it's deeper than that. What we want to argue for is something that I agree with you, that majorities of people should embrace, can embrace, will embrace, if we are clear about it, if we can bring it operationally into the world in a way that makes sense. And so to me, I want to argue again and again that institution is in a free society, even a society that has mere aspirations toward freedom. The path is distinct. And it values specifically, you know, these are values for specifically free people. Initiative and courage should be applauded. Imagination and creativity should be nourished. Nonconformity and noncompliance respected. Ingenuity and enterprise nurtured. Dissent and disagreement encouraged. And diversity and dissimilarity celebrated. These are hallmarks of a free people. So to the extent that this has been made into some kind of a boogeyman by the fearmongers and the people who are frightened about the future, and I understand that. I think we live in a wobbly, complicated, crisis-driven society, and people are fearful. Our job, it seems to me, the job of educators, of organizers, of progressive people, as of free thinkers, is to become very clear that the world we have in mind is not one that will lock people out, but is a society that will embrace us all and allow for more freedom, more peace, more joy, more justice.
That's what I remember, Bill. I don't know if you remember all the way back. Our first introduction actually was when I was with the Penn State system back in, I think, 2009. You came to speak on our campus, and people were like, "Wait, Bill Ayers is coming to, what in the world? Are you crazy?" And in fact, Bill, you did a masterful lesson with, again, people who came to that talk to argue with you. I remember this, there was three guys in the back, all dressed out in camouflage, you know, hunters from the woods of Pennsylvania. And there you are at the end of the talk, having a conversation with them and them saying, boy, this Bill Ayers guy, I mean, we agree with the things that you're saying. And I think it's because of just the way you just said that, Bill, is that it's not exclusionary. I do believe in freedom the way you guys, you duck hunters, believe in freedom. And in fact, you're part of the conversation that I'm asking and inviting you into. And I think maybe that is this moment is also for us to redefine and reimagine how we re-enter this conversation now in this moment, because I think what we offer in our vision of diversity, equity, and inclusion is empowering, is exciting, is innovative. And as you point out, a majority of people want to take part in this celebration. And here we have this moment now to go, you know what? Okay, let's take this time now, instead of digging our heels potentially in, is going, how do we then come forward in this moment to invite those people that feel excluded? How do we help them understand that this is a message of hope and that they're also included? I had a little ramble there. Sorry, but Bill, I had to remember. I was just thinking of that conversation when you were at Penn State with me.
No, it was great. And I this has happened to me many times. Speaking at Georgia State, a group showed up with American Patriot posters on their Hell's Angels jackets. And I ended up having a really good conversation with them. And among the things we agreed on is that they liked it, that they had a highway that they could ride their motorcycles on. And I called it a socialist road. But I think it's what you're saying that's really important is that, you know, I think Trumpism offers more than an outlet for economic frustration. It's an emotional narrative, and it addresses the existential fears that people have, that we're living in a dying empire on a dying planet. And that narrative is muddled, ever-changing. You know, it's got scapegoats, conspiracies, madness built into it. And now even Elon Musk is in it. You know, it's kind of, there's endless jokes. But it recognizes the dark horizon that we're rapidly approaching. And the Democrats' primary response is to say, look, let's talk about that later. For now, we should hold back the Trump tide. Not good enough. We have to do better than that. We have to say, no, we have also a vision. And it's a vision of people living in harmony with one another, with nature, with the planet, and people living without the economic anxiety that's driving us all crazy. So here we are spending billions on war and militarization of the police. And here we are without healthcare, with millions of people unhoused. That's an atrocity. And people feel the fear. They feel the anxiety. We need to address that in a real way, not in some kind of slick, you know, we can be just like the Republicans way. And I think the Democrats have dropped the ball again and again. And when they do drop the ball, instead of doing a deep, deep inward look, they tend to say, well, it's the fault of Black men, or the fault of Arab voters, or the fault of young people not turning out. It's not anybody's fault except the political class themselves for kind of not putting forward a vision that speaks both emotionally and practically to the real needs people have for meaning, for sensibility, for safety, and for purpose in life.
Mm. Johnny Lupinacci, so much, right?
Oh yeah, I love it. I love it. And Bill, you know, it's in harmony, and it resonates with some things I learned from my teacher, one of my teachers, Grace Lee Boggs, rest in power. I know Bill would come to Detroit and have conversations with Grace and do lots of teachings with Detroit Summer and Allied Media Conference, and Detroit being a little bit of a canary in the coal mine for activists for this moment, and inspiring us to be creative and to, you know, enact a politics of direct action and creatively with hope and joy to really make change. So Bill, as you know, you're sparking that fire for me again. You know, it's always right there burning as a Detroiter, but I'm excited as an educator, Bill, to be in conversation with you today and to ask you too, like, where are you getting some of that hope, joy, and creative resistance from? You know, like what kind of music or what kind of stuff you have to share, or things that, you know, are inspiring you to keep walking. I like how you said that in that conversation you had with Galliano, right? It's a good way to keep walking. So what are some of the things that are pushing you and inspiring you to keep walking, Bill?
Well, there's so many people in Chicago who are my chosen family. I mean, my biological family is a joy to me. My kids, my daughters-in-law, my grandchildren, but my chosen family includes some young activists who are not giving up, who are pointing the way. I'm so glad you invoked our friend Grace Lee Boggs and Jimmy Boggs. They were always an inspiration. And one of the things about Detroit, Grace had two slogans that drove people crazy near the end. One was, Detroit is all of us. And that's true. You know, the idea that somehow you can live in some gated community and Detroit is somebody else's problem. Detroit is all of us. And she also said, Detroit is the future. And what she meant by that is we can find a way to evolve, to organize, to create a revolution in values in order to have a revolution in fact. And Grace always pointed in that direction. For me, I get a lot of strength from the million experiments that I see going on all over the country. I don't see one great organization or one great movement that is defining everything. But if you look closely, Detroit's a great example. Chicago's a great example. We have projects and possibilities in every corner of Chicago. And the young activists driving those projects give me enormous hope. The other thing that gives me hope, Johnny, I look historically. I point you to two things. Let's imagine the four of us are having this conversation in 1845, and we're abolitionists. And we recognize that we're a tiny minority. We stand as abolitionists against the Constitution, the founders, the law, our parents, the Bible, our preacher, our neighbors. Holy cow. And yet we're abolitionists. And we also recognize that slavery is embedded in the entire country. The whole economy flows from slavery. So it's not just the South. It's every bank. It's every shipping company. It's everything depends on slavery. But damn it, we're against it. And we're going to organize. And so we organize and we knock doors and we put out leaflets and newspapers and propaganda. We support those who are the working, the African workers who are escaping from slavery. We support them physically, emotionally, and we try to get certain people elected. But it's 1845. It doesn't seem possible. We're a teeny tiny minority. And in 15 years, it will be done. Holy cow. Who could have thought that? And yet, they didn't give up and they didn't bury their heads. They kept pushing toward a world that could be, but was not yet. I look at the abolition of the death penalty in Illinois. 20 years ago this month, we abolished the death penalty. How did we do it? Well, the guys themselves, the people on death row, began a study group. That led to the death row 10, which led to the mothers of the death row 10, which led to a social movement. And we never backed up. But if you had told me 30 years ago that Illinois would lead the nation in abolishing slavery, I would have said, you're nuts. But because it happened, I know other things can happen. I think we can abolish in Illinois death by incarceration, which we do still have. We don't have death by execution, but death by incarceration. I think we can move toward a vision of a world in balance in which the capitalist climate collapse, which is upon us, can be stopped. And it can be stopped because it's within our power and our hands to stop it. But we have to unite arm in arm, heart to heart, to the barricades, and we have to be smart about it. So I'm encouraging people right at this moment, get in small groups, study groups, action groups, find the people you trust politically, be in conversation, and then reach out to a neighbor, talk to strangers. That's the essence of being a teacher. That's the essence of being an organizer for democracy.
And that's what we do all the time on Busted Pencils, Bill. Thanks for bringing us back to that. Our neighbors, reaching out to our neighbors. Man, that reminds me. Now for our moment of zen. History can untie our minds, our bodies, our disposition to move, to engage life rather than contemplating it as an outsider. It can do this by widening our view to include the silent voices of the past so that we look behind the silence of the present. Big thanks to our guest, Bill Ayers. Love having him on. Classes in session. Make sure you're around Friday. Yeah, we've got that drop. And then Saturday, The 1 hour drop, 3 o'clock across all the civic media connections. And man, everybody, keep busting pencils.